from deep inside your radio.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen, and this is probably the longest period of time that anybody in this city has gone in the last little while without saying those two well-known syllables, beginning with W and D, and I don't mean 40. As many of you are hearing this broadcast, it's before the Super Bowl. As some of you, including in New Orleans, are hearing this broadcast, it's in the middle of the game. So what are you doing listening to me? Hello, thank you so much. And as the fates would have it, I am in fact in Miami in the stadium right now as you hear this. Somebody very nice did something very nice. So this program is being recorded a few hours earlier. And I'm assuming that everything has gone well in the intervening time, including the fact that I've survived my own challenge. That is that my rental car, ladies and gentlemen, is a Toyota. Oh, what a feeling. Well, you know, here's the thing. I only put my foot on the brake. Yes, it slows me down, takes a little longer to get around town. But on the other hand, ladies and gentlemen, the nuclear world, news of the nukes, depends who you believe, or whom, for that matter. The Russian military allegedly dumped allegedly dumped nuclear waste into the Baltic Sea in the early 1990s. That's according to a report on Swedish television. Well, that's a way to get rid of the waste. Why didn't we think of that? Dump it in the Baltic Sea. We didn't have maps. We didn't have ships. Radioactive material from a military base in Latvia is thought to have been thrown into Swedish waters. For many, the biggest shock is that the Swedish government may have known at the time and done nothing about it. The Baltic is known as one of the most polluted seas in the world, so what the hell? But it now seems it was used as a dumping ground for Russian nuclear waste and chemical weapons. That's right, and we attacked Saddam. According to a report on Swedish television, Russian boats sailed out at night to dump barrels of radioactive material from a military base in Latvia. Even though the Swedish government knew at the time, reportedly no action was taken to find the waste. The current government in Stockholm now wants the politicians who were then in charge to explain why they... Oh, they're looking backwards. You see, we got to look forward, Swedes. Please. You know, the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue is coming up. Think of it. The Baltic Sea is semi-enclosed, so it takes a long time to flush out toxins. This makes it particularly vulnerable to pollution. And after years of untreated waste from Russia's cities and heavy industry, scientists say the Baltic is in danger of becoming a Dead Sea. You can imagine how that makes the Dead Sea feel. Dead. On the other hand, the former commander of the Russian Navy's Baltic fleet has denied those reports. This is complete nonsense and a clear provocation propagated at an international level, according to Vladimir Yegorov. He's an admiral who commanded the Baltic Fleet from 1991 to 2000. The naval forces that were pulling out of the naval base in Latvia in the early 1990s did not have chemical weapons, radioactive materials, and waste, according to Yegorov. He said the Russian naval forces were monitored by Latvia. All right, that makes me feel better. And if you don't feel better yet, radioactive tritium, a carcinogen discovered in potentially dangerous levels in groundwater at the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant, has now tainted at least 27 of this nation's 104 nuclear reactors. That would be a quarter, for those of you paying attention, raising concerns about how it's escaping from the aging nuclear plants. Of course, who isn't aging? Who's getting younger? Hands? A couple of nuclear plants in the back. The leaks, mainly from deteriorating underground pipes, those will last 10,000 years, swear to God, come as the nuclear industry is seeking and obtaining federal license renewals, casting itself as a clean, green alternative. It's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, it's too thin to meter. Tritium found in nature in tiny amounts and a product of nuclear fusion has been linked to cancer if ingested, inhaled, or absorbed through the skin in large amounts. So, regulate your dose of tritium, ladies and gentlemen. That's good advice from the people here at the Show Dome. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission said this week that new tests at a monitoring well at Vermont Yankee registered 70,000 picocuries per liter, more than three times the federal safety standard. That's the highest reading yet at Vermont Yankee. We've been keeping track of Vermont Yankee for you. You don't have to thank me. The existence of tritium in such low levels does not present a risk to public health or safety whatsoever. We are reassured by the plant spokesman, Robert Williams. You want to take that to the bank? Oh, the bank's closed today. NRC spokesman Neil Sheehan says leaks have occurred at least 27 of the nation's 104 nuclear reactors at 65 sites. He says the list likely does not include every plant where tritium has leaked. The leaks have several causes. Underground pipes corroding and the leaking of spent fuel storage pools are the most common. So, police your spent fuel storage pools, ladies and gentlemen. Keep your kids out of them. Many radiological health scientists agree with the EPA that tritium, like other radioactive isotopes, can cause cancer. But, says Steve Karekes, spokesman for the Nuclear Energy Institute, an industry group, the public shouldn't be unduly worried. Just duly. Quote, these are industrial facilities, and any industrial facility from time to time is going to have equipment problems or challenges. Not every operational issue rises to the level of being a safety issue, he says. Unquote. On the other hand, Richard Monson, Associate Dean for Professional Education and Professor of Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health, says there is no threshold of exposure below which low levels of ionizing radiation can be demonstrated to be harmless or beneficial. Unquote. I'd rather believe the spokesman, but that's just me. Hello, welcome to the show.
African call Hannibal.
Rock it, roll it, send it down the avenue.
Went out to see the Roman Empire fall.
Uh-huh.
2,000 elephants and gold chain mail.
Take it, shake it, make it what you wanna be.
Them Roman legionnaires, they hit the trail.
The world is what you make it. The world is what you make it, baby. The world is what you make it.
Oh. When Cleopatra lived in Egypt's land,
jump down, turn around, look for what the monkey did.
She went to find herself a mighty man. Then come Antonio from Italy.
Haul it, drag it up the pyramid.
He never knew how hard a girl could be.
Don't it? The world is what you make it. The world is what you make it, baby. The world is what you make it. Hey.
Them windows, let the sun shine through. There ain't no happy time without no pain.
Heartbreak, new day, moving up the alleyway.
Pick up them pieces, hit the road again.
The world is what you make it. The world is what you make it, baby. The world is what you make it. Yeah. world is what you make it, baby. The world is what you make it. That's all.
Overlooking the Mississippi River. On this week's edition, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this week's edition of the show. Yes, I said this week's edition twice in that sentence. No copy editor, babe. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. Haven't done this in a while, have I? No, Harry, you haven't. First of all, media consultant Frank Magid dies. I'll read it for you. Yes, I will. From broadcasting and cable, Frank Magid, namesake of the media consultancy Frank N. Magid Associates, passed away this week in Santa Barbara. He was 78. Magid was retired from Magid Associates, but held an honorary chairman's title. Magid Associates consults for numerous stations across the country and provides other professional services, ranging from executive coaching to e-commerce consulting. Frank Magid demanded perfection led by example and inspired excellence in everyone he touched, said Frank Magid TV president Steve Ridge. Frank was a true visionary, Ridge continued, who applied his genius and changed the landscape of television, unquote. That's from broadcasting and cable. And, you know, normally, ladies and gentlemen, when someone dies, you just sort of... You have the complimentary and not the critical. But following NPR's lead, when Howard Zinn died this week, the left-wing writer, they had David Horowitz on to say what a horrible guy he was, just for balance, during an obituary. So let's balance Frank Magid's obituary just by saying what he did was invent eyewitness news and was denounced for it by none other than Walter Cronkite. Just, you know, for balance. Now, from Media Daily News, whoever thought football would become a political football? The Super Bowl has again become a battleground for various advocacy groups and sponsors whose ads are felt to have political implications. This year has brought several controversies, the latest surrounding an ad for a gay dating site called ManCrunch.com, whose ad CBS has rejected. Submitted to CBS about 2 weeks ago, the ManCrunch.com ad showed two male football fans watching TV, then accidentally touching hands when they reach for the same potato chip. There's a moment of hesitation, and then the men begin kissing. After showing the website URL, the ad concludes with a pan to the left, where a third male football fan observes the sudden turn of events with a surprised look on his face. After 2 weeks' consideration, CBS informed ManCrunch.com that its ad had been rejected in a note reading, quote, CBS Standards and Practices has reviewed your proposed Super Bowl ad and concluded that the creative is not within the network's broadcast standards for Super Bowl Sunday, unquote. The CBS note did not give any reason for the decision, leaving it unclear what objections were voiced by its Standards and Practices division. While the two men appear to be engaged in an intense makeout session, the viewer never actually sees their mouths come in contact. The man who initiates the action turns away from the camera suddenly, giving the kiss a staged, over-the-top feel reminiscent of slapstick. By some standards, that's tamer than the infamous Snickers ad that actually showed two men briefly kissing as they lunged after the same candy bar. Dominic Friesen, a spokesman for ManCrunch.com, said, we're very disappointed that in 2010 such discrimination is happening, especially given the fact that Focus on the Family is allowed to promote their way of life during the Super Bowl. Friesen refers to the other main ad controversy this year, CBS accepted an ad from Focus on the Family, a conservative organization in which University of Florida quarterback Tim Tebow and his mother relate a personal story to illustrate their opposition to abortion. Previous Super Bowls have had controversies over what some saw as an excessive number of ads for ED cures. And of course, CBS is the network whose standards and practices included the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction that has us all very worried about big fines for saying profanity. Thanks, Les Moonves. You won't see the Man Crunch ad. Something you might not even have missed had I not read the trades for you. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Super Sunday around the world.
Here in Reykjavik, the natives tie gaily colored strips of fur and ribbon to the street lamps that illuminate the long nighttime winter each Super Sunday. Exchanges of small gifts of meat or fish pies are commonplace. In the evening, children troop through the frozen streets, throwing candles into trash cans. The day climaxes at 3 the next morning, when lines at Finnish Daila Sport are jammed with callers anxious to know the final score. And then to bed. For in Finland, the day after Super Sunday is Vilgafjorsk, or a normal working day. This is Bill Malone in Finland.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. It is a movement. And it's moving. Tony Blair will act as a paid consultant for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympic Games. But Henry Kissinger wasn't available. They looked in the online find a war criminal. What's Tony going to do? He's going to urge the Olympic Committee to invade Iraq. No. Close. The former prime minister will advise the organizers of the sporting event and will give at least one speech. Oh, please, Tony. More. More than one. Blair has made an estimated $25 million since retiring as prime minister. Good on you, mate. He's the world's highest paid public speaker, which must tick Bill Clinton off. His fee for assisting in the Rio Games has not yet been set, or at least announced. Blair agreed to accept the role during a meeting at his London home last week. Sergio Cabral, governor of the state of Rio de Janeiro, said Tony Blair is largely responsible for London winning and hosting the Olympics in 2012. And for building the Millennium Dome, he didn't mention. And for invading Iraq. Oh. Hiring him provides a great bridge between London and Rio, said Cabral. He said Blair's fee would be paid by private sponsorship and not from public funds. Come on, get into training now, and you can be there with Blair. And in other news of the Olympic movement, Dateline Wellington, New Zealand, a New Zealand Taekwondo athlete who opened a brothel to finance his Olympic campaign. Hey, Tony, there's your money for the speech right there. That New Zealand Taekwondo athlete is auctioning off the brothel and will use the proceeds to pay his way to overseas competitions, he announced this week. Logan Campbell, who finished in the top 16 in the featherweight division at the Beijing Olympics, was condemned by the New Zealand Olympic Committee when he opened a high-class gentleman's club in Auckland to finance future competition. The NZOC said such a business went against Olympic principles. The same principles that prohibit hiring a war criminal. Oh, no, they don't. Campbell will sell the business on an auction website and hopes to raise $210,000 toward the cost of his bid to represent New Zealand at the 2012 Olympic Games in London. The business is listed on the New Zealand website Trade Me. The Olympics. It's a movement. And everybody needs one every day. It must make you proud to be Dick Ebersol right about now. Ladies and gentlemen, news from the digital wonderland. Comcast, the nation's largest cable TV provider, as well as the largest in the Sacramento area, is going to stop providing about 50 channels in analog format by the end of next month. The move lets the company increase its digital offerings, but means thousands of customers will have to install new equipment to maintain their current level of service. The whole world has been swept along in this digital tsunami, says Comcast spokesman Brian Bird. I think he thinks a tsunami is a good thing. Those who subscribe to the lowest level of cable TV service, known as Limited Basic, don't have to do anything. They will continue to receive the same service without new equipment. Nor is any change necessary for TVs that already receive digital service. But new set-top boxes will be required for subscribers who want to continue receiving mid-level service, known as Expanded Basic. Gee, if Dick Cheney were running Comcast, it would be Enhanced Basic on all of, or some of their TVs. Those who don't add the new equipment before Comcast shuts off the analog signal will be able to receive only the 30 or so channels offered in the Limited Basic package, losing CNN, Disney Channel, and Lifetime. They're not basic enough. The new boxes, a large one for a main TV and smaller ones for additional sets, will be hooked up by Comcast for $15.99, or you can try doing it yourself. An extra monthly charge could come if more than three TVs require boxes. But why would you have more than nobody has more than three TVs in their house now, do they? Expanded Basic customers will get 30 new channels on Expanded Basic, including Country Music Television and MSNBC. Conversion efforts in other Comcast cities have had their share of headaches. In Atlanta, which Comcast converted last summer, news reports quoted subscribers complaining of poor service and problems combining existing equipment with the new technology. Telecommunications analyst Jeff Kagan said he saw that frustration in Atlanta up close. One of the biggest problems, he says, is Comcast is moving too fast. Hey, they got to buy NBC. They got to move. I think it's the right move, he says, but they should stagger it, allow customers to get used to the idea. Deborah Logan, a Comcast subscriber in Atlanta, said getting her VCR to work with her new equipment was a, quote, nightmare. If I could get my old service back, she says, I would be the first in line. Dropping analog channels allows Comcast to free up bandwidth to offer more digital services and high-definition options. Each analog signal dropped makes room for 12 digital channels or three high-definition channels, according to the Comcast spokesperson. And that's because, starting last year, Comcast began to compress their high-definition signals, so they're a little less high-definition, won't you? News of the digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
The very thought of you, can I forget to do those little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a king. It's strange as it may seem to me, that's everything. The mere idea of you, the longing here for you, you never know how slow the moments go when I'm near, so near to you. I see your face in every flower, your eyes in stars above. Just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love. Can I forget to do those little ordinary things that everyone ought to do? I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a king. And strange though it may seem to me, that's everything. The mere idea of you, the longing here for you. Yes, you never know how slow the moment goes when I'm near to you. I see your face in every flower, your eyes in stars of love. Yes, the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love.
This is Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Here's one for the Leave Humor to the Professionals file. Dateline, Litchfield Park, Arizona. Litchfield Elementary School Superintendent Julianne Lean has recommended that a district school principal who wrote a sarcastic letter about students that was mistakenly sent home to parents be reassigned to a district office position. She's also working to hold a meeting for parents to discuss their concerns. The letter sent home with second graders attending Litchfield Elementary included disparaging remarks about students who could not complete their easy math assignments. Some parents who read the letter say it's funny. Others don't think the letter is a laughing matter. The district, however, apologizes for the incident and is taking steps to remedy the situation, including removing Principal Ron Stare, pending disciplinary action. Stare, he says he wrote a joke letter in response to caustic comments made by an individual and a teacher accidentally sent it home. He said as he openly opposes the views expressed in the mocking letter he wrote, "I just thought it was a joke." Secretary of Education Arne Duncan this week apologized for saying that Hurricane Katrina was, quote, the best thing that happened to the New Orleans education system, unquote. Duncan said he made his observation in an improper way, but stressed that the city's school system has improved. "I said it in a poor way, and I apologize for that," he said. "It was a dumb thing to say." Speaking of dumb things, he called Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans to explain his remarks.
Sorry.
I wonder what city Nagin was in.
You know, man, it's hard.
Deadline Miami New York Jets coach Rex Ryan apologized for making an obscene gesture at some Miami Dolphins fans while attending a mixed martial arts event in Miami Saturday night. "It was stupid and inappropriate," Ryan said in a statement issued through the Jets. "I wouldn't accept that kind of behavior from one of the coaches or players, and it's unacceptable for me. I apologize to the Jets organization, the NFL, and NFL fans everywhere." Jets general manager Mike Tannenbaum criticized his coach. "Rex showed extremely poor judgment and his conduct was inappropriate. He knows he's wrong, has apologized, and we've accepted his apology." More NFL-related apologies coming up. Please stay tuned, won't you? Deadline Karachi, Pakistan, a repentant Pakistani cricket player, Shahid Afridi, has issued an unconditional apology to his country and to the cricket world after being penalized for ball tampering. He says he would not repeat the mad thing again in the future. Afridi was caught on television biting into the cricket ball during a match. He said he was sorry for having caused embarrassment to his countrymen and fans. "I really don't know what happened to me that made me do such a mad thing. It was not right, and I apologize for my actions to everyone," he said in an accent that didn't sound anything like that. Seeking to quell the firestorm over Toyota's sudden acceleration problems, I have a Yaris that I rented. The company's president issued a rare public apology this week. Facing unusually aggressive Japanese reporters, Akio Toyoda said he was deeply sorry about the inconvenience and concern caused to our customers and others. Toyoda, grandson of the company's founder, said the automaker had reached a moment of crisis and would form a global task force to improve quality. After saying he doesn't even care if his fans download it illegally, Keith Urban has apologized and confessed his statement came out wrong. He's apologized for appearing to encourage fans to illegally download his music, insisting he misspoke during a recent awards acceptance speech. He won Favorite Male Artist of the People's Choice Awards and thanked members of his fan club, Monkeyville, as he took to the stage. Praising fans for promoting his music online, he said, "I don't even care if you download it illegally. Give it to your friends. I really don't care," unquote. The remarks sparked outrage among the music industry. There's still a music industry? Urban now says he doesn't support the practice. "I didn't mean I want people to steal music, but a lot of people end up buying albums and turning their friends onto it. It came out wrong, and I apologize." Deadline Cleveland, fully clothed Grady Sizemore faced his public with nothing to hide, stung by having semi-nude photos of him posted on the internet. Cleveland's popular center fielder said he never intended for the photos, which Sizemore maintains were stolen from an email account, to be viewed publicly, and he regrets the embarrassment their exposure has caused. "It's a private matter, and personal photos were stolen illegally, unlike the other way, I guess. I've always tried to represent myself and the Cleveland organization as best as possible, and to put everybody through this is a terrible feeling. I apologize to everybody." In November, the photos, including one of Sizemore standing nearly naked in front of a bathroom mirror, appeared online. He says he took the photos for his girlfriend. What, she doesn't have a mirror? And there's more. A resident physician at a Long Island, New York hospital apologized to faculty members over the weekend for posting a photograph of a former classmate giving two thumbs up next to a cadaver. State health officials say they will be looking into the matter. In three separate emails, Erica Katz, who works in the emergency medicine unit at Stony Brook Medical Center, said posting the photo on our Facebook page was a mistake. It was absolutely unquestionably egregious, idiotic, disrespectful, and thoughtless for me ever to have taken that picture, and exponentially worse to have posted it on Facebook, she said. That's a good apology. In the same note, she said, I had not planned to take pictures of the cadaver. It was a spur-of-the-moment act of idiocy, and I can assure you that no other pictures were ever taken. I had honestly forgotten it existed, let alone that I had posted it online. The student who appeared in the picture, Aaron Hartman, also wrote to express his contrition. I sincerely apologize to the deans, professors of the anatomy course, and most importantly, to the deceased. Lindy England had no comment. Germany's top Jesuit apologized this week for serial sexual abuse apparently committed by two priests at one of Germany's most prestigious high schools, saying there was evidence of it for years, but Jesuit officials did not, quote, react the way it would have been necessary, unquote. That's elegant phraseology. That's Jesuitical phraseology. I'm ashamed that nothing was done at the time, said Father Stefan Dartmann, the head of the Jesuit Order of Germany. I also apologize that those responsible at the order at the time did not react the way it would have been necessary. Dartmann conceded the Jesuit Order had evidence of the sexual abuse cases since 1981, but had never informed students, parents, or authorities. Cases can no longer be prosecuted because of the statute of limitations. Nice work. Nearby, a retired Polish bishop who last week said the Shoah as such is a Jewish invention this week apologized for the remark in a statement published by the Roman Catholic Information Agency in Poland. Of course, my unfortunate statement, which was the result of a mental shortcut, does not express my views, said Bishop Tadeusz Pironek. Well, it's undeniable that most of those who died in the concentration camps were Jews. There were also Gypsies, Poles, Italians, and Catholics on the list, he was quoted as saying in an interview, so it's not permissible to appropriate this tragedy for propaganda, he said in his original interview published 2 days ahead of the 65th International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And the National Football League has conceded it does not own the phrase "Who dat?" or the fleur-de-lis symbol. The NFL conceded they have no exclusive ownership rights to the phrase "Who dat?" or "Who dat nation?" or the fleur-de-lis symbol, says Louisiana Attorney General James Buddy Caldwell. The NFL apologized to Saints fans after issuing cease and desist orders to several state merchants selling "Who dat?" products. The NFL admitted its mistake, saying stores may sell "Who dat?" merchandise if they don't label them as NFL items. And then the NFL turned right around to underline the fact that they employ the dumbest lawyer on planet Earth and stopped a movie theater and I believe a school from having a big screen showing of today's Super Bowl game. Even though, of course, they allow bars to and have an exemption for churches. The NFL did not clarify as to where they would get the extra revenue if the theater and schools were not allowed to have the big screen showings and send people home to watch it on free TV, sitting alone, instead of in a public place with their friends. It all put me in mind that the things in the NFL are pretty much the same as they were way back when Super Bowl players started rapping.
We shoot the bull, we're the Super Bowl crew, hustling to make 100 million or two. We talk and we talk, though it all sounds the same, and at the end of it all, there might be a game. We're not trying to use a lot of muscle, we're just doing the Super Bowl hustle. We'll be right back.
me Pete. I play this game without leaving my seat. My plan was simple, it worked just fine. All three networks push my line. Hard or soft, it's all a sell. Or my name isn't Roselle. Marketing is part of my every corpuscle, so it's no trick for me to do the Super Bowl hustle.
We are the players, pieces of meat. We went to college and we learned how to eat. We block and we tackle, we run and we throw. And now we even get to do a video. We're big and we're strong, mighty and mean. And we talk lots of trash on your TV screen. To shut us up, you might need a muzzle. Cause we're just doing the Super Bowl hustle.
From the media crowd. We amplify the high till it gets real loud. The questions and the answers, we know them by heart. But we like to party, and we know our part. We thump this tub, though our hearts aren't in it, because we can sell the time for $1 million a minute. We like to hear those dollar bills rustle, so you know we'll be doing the Super Bowl hustle. Oh, my. Oh, my.
We shoot the bowl, we're the Super Bowl crew. To make $100 million or two. We talk and we talk, though it all sounds the same. And at the end of it all, there might be a game. We're not trying to use a lot of muscle. We're just doing the Super Bowl hustle.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Some delicious stuff, some bubblicious stuff this week on Iraq. First of all, from the past, blasting. Tony Blair's cabinet was misled into thinking the war with Iraq was legal. That's according to the former International Development Secretary Claire Short, speaking, testifying before the Iraq inquiry. I know they're having an inquiry into the Iraq war in Britain. They're looking back. They're not looking forward. What's wrong with them? She said Attorney General Lord Goldsmith had been leaned on to change his advice before the invasion. Blair and his mates, she said, decided war was necessary and, quote, everything was done on a wing and a prayer. She quit the cabinet 2 months after the invasion in protest at the planning for the war's aftermath. In her evidence of the Iraq inquiry, during which she was highly critical of Blair, she said the cabinet had not been a decision-making body, as it's supposed to be under the British system, and called Parliament a rubber stamp. She was given a round of applause after her three-hour appearance. She added she had been conned into staying on as a minister until May of that year, 2 months after the invasion, despite her misgivings about the war. She was persuaded to stay on with promises of UN involvement in the reconstruction of Iraq. A definitive statement circulated at the cabinet meeting 3 days before the war began. She said there was no suggestion given that the Attorney General had any legal doubts, and said that any discussion of the legal advice was halted at that pre-war cabinet meeting. She was shocked that the Attorney General's advice was so late, but was, quote, jeered at to be quiet by other ministers when she asked why. She said when she repeated the question to the Attorney General, he had replied, quote, oh, it takes me a long time to make my mind up, unquote. In light of what we now know to be the Attorney General's doubts and his changes of opinion that have since emerged, Short said, quote, I think for the Attorney General to come and say there's unequivocal legal authority to go to war was misleading. I think he misled the cabinet. He certainly misled me, but people let it through. She said that after the failure to secure a second UN resolution, the British government had put out untrue claims that France had vetoed it. But she said she believed them at the time. You don't want to disbelieve your prime minister in the run-up to war, and you want to believe the leader of your party. Asked why she did not resign earlier, she said, quote, I was conned. Unquote. How much is Tony making now? He's a pro. He was a con, now he's a pro. And now Iraq today, the Iraqi National Congress, under the leadership of, say it with me, Ahmed Chalabi, has issued a blistering denunciation of U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Christopher Hill. Hill had criticized the Justice and Accountability Commission, chaired by Chalabi, because it barred 511 candidates from the forthcoming Iraqi elections. The statement from Chalabi's Congress says, referring to Hill's self-criticism about the legacy of mistakes the U.S. made in Iraq, quote, Hill argued that the biggest mistake was the de-Ba'athification, while all Iraqis know, according to the Iraqi National Congress, quote, that the biggest mistake was the occupation. Thanks, Ahmed. I thought that was your idea. But wait, there's more outside the bubble. Let's look forward, ladies and gentlemen. Dateline Kabul, Afghanistan, from the McClatchy Papers. Thousands of U.S., British, and Afghan troops are poised to launch the biggest offensive of the war in Afghanistan. Military operations usually are intended to catch the enemy off guard. For weeks, U.S. and allied officials have been telling reporters about their forthcoming assault on Marjah, a Taliban-held town of 80,000 and a drug trafficking hub. Senior NATO commanders and top Afghan officials have openly discussed the approximate time of Operation Moshtarak, the word for together, and Dari, the size of the force and their objectives in news conferences, interviews, and press releases. Leaflets have been airdropped on the town. The exact time of the kickoff hasn't been disclosed. A news article posted Thursday on the British Ministry of Defense's website announced that operations had been underway for 36 hours. The unusual approach, according to U.S. and British commanders, is intended to persuade the civilian population to leave or turn against the Taliban, while pressuring the estimated 2,000 insurgents to flee the town or switch sides. Of course, if they flee the town, they'll show up in another town. And also from the McClatchy newspapers, a U.S. military investigation into a battle last October in eastern Afghanistan that cost 8 American soldiers their lives has concluded the small outpost was worthless, the troops there didn't understand their mission, and intelligence and air support were tied up elsewhere in the province. According to an unclassified executive summary of the report, there were inadequate measures taken by the chain of command, resulting in an attractive target for enemy fighters. The investigation found that soldiers repelled an enemy force of 300 anti-Afghan force fighters, preserving their combat outpost. U.S. forces sustained 8 killed in action. The soldiers distinguished themselves, but the report says that the combat outpost was located deep in a bowl surrounded by high ground with limited protection from one observation post. There was no tactical or strategic value to holding the ground occupied by the post. As a result, the chain of command decided to close the remote outpost as soon as it could. The closure was delayed, however, when the manpower and equipment needed to shut the base, as well as aerial drones and other reconnaissance equipment, were diverted to support a military operation elsewhere. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. One final apology this week before we close the apology file. You know White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel apologized this week for using the word retarded during a private meeting last summer in which he was denouncing members of the liberal base of the Democratic Party for making it harder for President Obama to compromise on his health care reform plan. Rahm Emanuel now tells advocates for the disabled he will join their campaign to help end the use of the word retarded. He had privately apologized previously to Special Olympics Chief Executive Tim Shriver shortly after the comment was made public last week. Shriver, in a statement, said Emanuel had sincerely apologized for the earlier comment, and Emanuel aide declined comment. The Wall Street Journal had reported last week Emanuel used the phrase effing retarded during a meeting with liberal activists in August. Controversy erupted when Sarah Palin, noting the Emanuel quote, called on President Obama to fire him. And then Rush Limbaugh took to the air.
There's Rahm Emanuel out there who is in big trouble for calling liberals, for calling liberal activists effing retards. You know, Emanuel's getting ticked off out there saying, well, you blame us. What are you blaming us for? We didn't do anything about it, you effing retards. But our political correct society is acting like some giant insult's taking place by calling a bunch of people who are retards, retards. I think the big news is that he's out there calling Obama's number one supporters effing retards. So now there's going to be a meeting. There's going to be a retard summit at the White House. Retard, 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 retards.
Holiday for Retards with Rush Limbaugh. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I feel bad about being in a Toyota, but I could be in a plane. Government inspectors this week harshly criticized the FAA for its response to the Colgan air crash a year ago, saying the agency's effort to get airlines to voluntarily fix safety problems had not addressed the problems the accident raised. Of the FAA's 10 initiatives tied to the voluntary call to action effort, 8 are either falling behind schedule or not meeting their intended goals, according to the Department of Transportation's Inspector General. Most importantly, the FAA has fallen behind in developing tougher rules on pilot training and fatigue, and has inadequately reviewed training programs at the airlines. FAA also has not followed up to ensure air carriers' call to action of commitments effectively meet planned safety goals, says the Inspector General of the DOT. Other critical issues emerged after the accident remain unaddressed, such as potential correlations between pilot experience and compensation. Colgan Air operated the flight for Continental. It crashed last February 12th. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, the FAA did good work. And the Defense Department Inspector General's report has stirred debate at the Pentagon over what constitutes a conflict of interest. The report determined that the Pentagon test agencies gave $91 million in contracts for advice and assistance to corporations that helped develop the system. The Inspector General says the advisory service contracts won by Select Applications International conflicted with defense regulations, but the Department's Office of Operational Test and Evaluation and the Army's Test Command disagreed based on their interpretations of the regulations. Gentlemen, as you were, news of the Inspector General, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, before the New York Times can copy it anymore, a tale of airport security. Rose writes, "Dear Harry, after a family gathering in Oregon, staying in a rented house at a resort, my husband and I hurriedly packed to the airport. Our nearby family had brought lots of homemade food and kitchen tools to supply the cabin, so offered to send us back to L.A. with a bag of food as carry-on. We gratefully accepted the offer, grabbed the bag, and off we went. We had no trouble going through security with the food as it was solid, not gel or liquid. It was only the next day when I removed the bag of food from the fridge, where I'd hastily placed it upon arrival late the night before, that I found something amiss. In the bag, wedged between Ziplocs of food, was a very sharp pair of steel scissors with 6-inch blades. Though glad not to have lost such a valuable item. I was surprised, to say the least. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, so that means nothing at all. And that concludes this week's edition of the show. Speaking of nothing at all, the program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it on your computer, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free download to members at audible.com/theshow. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like New Orleans owning Who Dat after all, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, In Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. And thanks to Mike Newport at KCRW for helping to retrieve today's broadcast. I'd like to thank the Academy, but I won't. Playlists for the music heard here on and a mailing email address for the broadcast are available always at harryshearer.com. And the show is on Twitter at LeTwits. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Pray for me. I'm in a Toyota. Happy Mardi Gras, everybody.